Exodus. And one thing that we've seen in the book of Genesis that is very obvious, though there's very little actual calling attention to it by the writer, yet it's very obvious, is God's direction of history. How God directs the lives of individuals even when they're not aware of it, in order to bring them to the circumstances that He has in mind for their eventual good. We saw this in the lives, in the life of Abraham and in the life of Jacob particularly, and Joseph, how that God's providence worked through what seemed to be natural circumstances, in the case of Joseph especially, where his brothers sold him into Egypt. And he was a slave there, and it seemed to be going the wrong direction from the way that he had dreamed. He had dreamed of his brothers bowing to him, and yet now he was sold into slavery, and it seemed as though he'd never see his brothers again, nor his father. But that was the very circumstance that was required in order to get his brethren saved from the famine that was yet to come in the land of Canaan, and to bring them into Egypt. Even the famine itself in Canaan, no doubt, was intended as a means of getting the Jews to feel pressured into going into Egypt. There were two promises that God made in the book of Genesis that have to do with the Jews being in Egypt. One of those promises was made to Jacob as he left from his home to come and rejoin his son Joseph after he heard that Joseph was alive in Egypt. In Genesis chapter 46 and verses 2 and 3, God had said to Jacob, says, God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down to Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand on thine eyes. Now here, this promise made to Jacob as he was just taking his whole family into Egypt was that he should not fear to go down there, that he would become, that his little clan, his family, would become a great nation while in Egypt. When we get to Exodus chapter 1, we find that about 300 or more years have passed since this promise was made. Maybe we could say closer to 400 years by the time we get to Exodus chapter 1. And so the nation of Israel, or the people of Israel, had become a great nation during those intervening centuries. Another statement, of course, that we saw in this passage is that I will surely bring thee up again. That is, I will bring the people of Israel again out of Egypt back into the promised land. Now, Jacob had wanted to remain in the promised land because it was very clearly the land he was to inherit. And going into Egypt might seem to challenge their future prospects there, that they might lose their claim. Anything that they'd, any foothold they'd gained in the promised land might be lost by going into a foreign country for a period of time. And yet God promised that while in Egypt they would become a great nation, and it would be as a great nation and not only as a small clan that they would return and take possession of the land of Canaan. If you go back even further in Genesis, back to Genesis chapter 15, there was another prediction that the Jews had to cherish while they were in Egypt. This had been made to Abraham, or even before he was called Abraham, it was made to Abram, their ancestor. And it's in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13. God said to Abraham, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. So he says that I will have them 400 years in a land that is not their own. They'll be aliens there. They'll be afflicted there. Now the statement here is that they will be afflicted for 400 years. It may sound as though they would be slaves for that entire period. The events of Exodus seem to imply that they were not slaves the entire period. In a sense, they might be seen to be afflicted in that they were exiles from their own land for that whole period of time. And whenever the Jews were out of their homeland, even if they were treated relatively nicely, as in the case of the Babylonian captivity, where they were not greatly oppressed, but they were in exile from their homeland, that was a time of affliction. It was a time of being homesick. But as far as the actual slavery and the abuse that they suffered under the pharaohs, that seems to have been taking place only under one or two of the pharaohs. Two, apparently. And so that would not be for the entire 400-year period, but the latter part of it. Nonetheless, a period of 400 years had been predicted way back hundreds of years earlier in the days of Abraham. And God had said that the Jews would spend that period of time, and yet He would bring them out with great substance. He repeated a similar promise to Jacob that we just read a moment ago. And so these promises were with the Jews as they went into Egypt. And just before Joseph died, he commanded his brethren to carry his bones and his remains out of Egypt and to bury them in Canaan at the time of their returning. So it's clear that though they had resettled in Egypt and found a comfortable life there at first, they still knew that the time would come when they would not be making their permanent home in Egypt, but they'd be going back to Canaan. And this was a hope that resided in the Jews the whole time they were there. Now, the book of Exodus begins the life of Moses. It is the second of the Pentateuch books, which, of course, it's considered that all the five books of Moses are written by Moses. But these latter four, beginning with Exodus and continuing through Deuteronomy, encompass the lifetime of Moses. We find his birth in chapter 2 of Exodus. And then his lifetime is covered for four more books of the Bible. In fact, the story of Moses takes up about 1/7 of the entire Bible, which is a rather disproportionately large segment, given his lifetime. 1/7 of the whole Bible, and it's actually about 2/3 the length of the New Testament in terms of chapter numbers. The life of Moses is about 2/3 as long in the Old Testament as the whole New Testament, which means that actually more chapters are given to his lifetime than even to the life of Jesus that's recorded in the four Gospels. Though that is certainly not to suggest that his life was any more significant. But we must say that in the Old Testament there shines forth no character greater than Moses. He is the greatest man of pre-Christian times. There is no man in the Old Testament to whom more miracles were attributed. Elijah and Elisha had done miracles. Other prophets had done miracles. But Moses is the man to whom the most miracles are attributed. He did the greatest thing. Now, of course, Abraham was venerated very highly by the Jews in pre-Christian times, but though he was venerated, he's remembered primarily for one thing. That is that his faith. His faith and his patience and the fact that he was the father of the whole race. But as far as actual achievements, Abraham did very little. And Moses outshines him very greatly in many respects because Moses did an incredible feat. He took what may have been between 2 million and 3 million slaves, people who had been enslaved for at least two generations, so that they had a slave-like mentality, and he led them to liberation and led them about and made them into a cohesive nation, one of the greatest nations and one of the most durable nations that history has ever seen. So durable, in fact, that the law code that was given through Moses when they came out of Egypt, which was the glue that held them together as a people, has continued to hold them together for something like 4,000 years. And the amazing thing about that is that very seldom, if ever, do you ever find a nation of people, a nationality of people, retaining their national identity for more than two or three or four generations if they have no homeland. And yet the Jews, since 70 AD until 1948, had no homeland of their own. They were scattered for almost 2,000 years, for 1,900 years, we might say, more accurately. And they were scattered throughout the world without a national homeland, and yet they retained their distinctive Jewishness, and that which made them Jewish was this law and this identity that they received through the leadership of Moses. And yet, when they had gone into Egypt, they were just a family, a relatively large family, we might say, 70 men plus their wives and possessions, slaves and so forth. But when they came out, they were 600,000 men, plus their wives and others. So we have quite a growth that took place in Egypt. Of course, that's not to be attributed to Moses. He came in near the tail end of that. But the fact that he took these people out of their slave-like condition, liberated them from the most powerful ruler of the world, and then led them, the largest parade ever that history has ever seen of 3 million people approximately, through the wilderness for 40 years and kept them together, gave them a law, and did all these things against incredibly opposing circumstances when you think about it. That makes him certainly the greatest achiever of the Old Testament. Of course, we know that he did all those things by the power of God, and that's why he was able to do it. He was a great man, and probably even if he had not been a godly man, there are things about him that would have made him go down in history as a great man. He was mighty in word and deed, we're told by Stephen in Acts chapter 7. And he was, of course, of the royal family, not by birth, not by blood, but by adoption. And he stood to gain a great deal in his early life. If he had stayed with Egypt, he might have gone down into history as one of the greatest pharaohs at some point. But we are told in the book of Hebrews that he chose to forsake Egypt and the pleasures of sin in order to throw in his lot with the Hebrew people and to become God's man of the hour, which he certainly was. And so we have a great portion of Scripture devoted to a description of Moses. Now Moses, of course, was supposed to lead the people out of Egypt and into a promised land. But if you have already read through Deuteronomy, you know that Moses never did lead them into the promised land. He was forbidden to do it because of a certain act of misbehavior on his part that took place during the 40 years wandering. And he never got to go into the promised land during his lifetime. Instead, he got to see it from a mountaintop across the river, and then he got to lay his hands on Joshua and make Joshua his successor to go over and take the people in. But Moses never got to go in. However, later, Moses did go in. A couple thousand years later, Moses and Elijah visited Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. And Moses did get to set foot in the promised land on that one mountain. And I'd like to show you something very interesting from Luke chapter 9 about this meeting. Luke 9. Beginning with verse 28, "And it came to pass about an 8 days after these sayings that Jesus took Peter and John and James and went up to the mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering. And behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elias," or Elijah, "who appeared in glory and spake of his decease which he should accomplish at Jerusalem." Now the reason I point out this passage is not only because Moses appears again, and this time inside the promised land, though he died and was buried outside the promised land, but because on this occasion, in verse 31, it says, "They appeared," Moses and Elijah appeared in glory, "and spoke of his decease." Now, in the Greek, this word decease is taken from the Greek word exodus, which is the name of our present book that we're studying. The word exodus means a way out, or a going out, or a departure. That's what the word exodus means. It is not the original name for the book. The Hebrews have different names for the books than we have of the Old Testament. The names that they give to the Old Testament books usually are made up of the first word or words of the book. For instance, the book of Genesis to the Jews is called "In the Beginning," because those are the first words in the book. In the book of Exodus to the Hebrews in their Bible is called "Now These Are the Names," because those are the first words of the book of Exodus. However, the Jewish translators who translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek in 285 B.C. and created the Septuagint version of the Bible, they gave it the Greek name of Exodus, the going out, or a way out. And so that is why we have that name attached to it today. Our Bible has retained the Greek names of the books from the Septuagint. But the interesting thing here is that Moses, who had led the people in the great departure, the great exodus, out of Egypt to freedom, out of the bondage of Pharaoh to a place of becoming the people of God, of becoming a kingdom and a peculiar treasure unto him, and ultimately made it possible for them to go in and take the promised land and become a mighty people of God. That Moses met with Jesus, who was going to lead God's people in a greater exodus. And he and Elijah spoke with Jesus about the exodus that Jesus was about to accomplish, going to Jerusalem. We know that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem to die. And that Jesus' death, in a sense, was an exodus. He exodus the world. He departed from the world. And by the way, that word is used also by Peter in 2 Peter 1:15 when he speaks about his death. In 2 Peter 1:15, in speaking about his death, Peter says, he speaks of his decease. He says, after my decease, you may have these things in my in remembrance. But the word decease there, again in the Greek Bible, is exodus. So our death is an exodus. And Jesus was going to Jerusalem to accomplish an exodus. He was going to die. But that's not the whole thing, because you don't accomplish your own death. Death is something that occurs to you, or that happens to you. It happens either by natural causes or by unnatural causes, through being killed in an accident or by murder. In Jesus' case, of course, he did lay down his life, but still the wording here, the exodus that he was about to accomplish, seems to speak more of just accomplishing death. That's not such a great accomplishment, just to die. But his death accomplished something much more, and that is a greater exodus, a greater going out of captivity. And so the book of Exodus, and the exodus that Moses led his people out of the bondage of Pharaoh, actually corresponds to a greater going out that Jesus provided for us, out of the captivity that we were held in sin, in the bondage of Satan. As Pharaoh, we might see as a picture of Satan. Egypt is a picture of the world. And Paul himself compares the Exodus and the experience of the Jews with our experience of being saved out of our bondage to sin. If we can turn to 1 Corinthians 10 for a moment, I'd like to illustrate that. So that when we get into the book of Exodus, actually, we will see that there is a spiritual correspondence. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Paul is remembering the Exodus. And he says, "Moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant, how that all our fathers were under the cloud, and all passed through the sea," that is the Red Sea, when Moses led them out. "They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat in the same spiritual food." Now that would be a reference to the manna that they received in Exodus chapter 16. "And they did all drink the same spiritual drink." That's the water that came out of the rock in Exodus 17. Okay, we're talking about events from the book of Exodus. "For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, but that rock, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples," or in the Greek, tupos, or types. They were types. "To the intent that we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted." Look a little later in verse 11. It says, "Now these things happened to them as types," or examples in the King James, examples, "and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come." That is to say that the things that happened to the Jews on this occasion, both these verses, verse 6 and verse 10, both use the word tupos in the Greek. These were types. The going out of the Jews from Egypt is a type of salvation through Christ. Moses is a type of Christ. And so as the Jews were baptized unto Moses in going through the water, so we are baptized into Christ in going through water, baptism. And baptized into the cloud, which was the presence of God, so we are baptized in His Holy Spirit. As they ate of the spiritual food, the manna that came down from heaven, Jesus said, "Your fathers ate bread from heaven and they're dead, but I am the true bread of life." We partake of Christ Himself. They drank from the water that flowed from the rock. Paul himself says the rock is Christ. Well, what water flows from Him? Jesus said, "He that believeth on Me, out of his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water." In John 7, and I don't have the reference at my fingertips, but it's in John chapter 7. We've looked at it before in other connections. I'll grab it for you here. Verse 38 and 39, he says this is with reference to the Holy Spirit. John 7, 38 and 39 is where there's a reference to the water, living water coming forth. So Paul brings these features out of the book of Exodus, out of the experience of the Jews, and he says these are types. And we can very readily see what they're types of, because the New Testament singles each one of these things out and says that there's something there for us. Also, the Exodus, of course, was accompanied by the Passover, or made possible by the Passover, which in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, it says, Jesus Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. So it's very clear that the story of the Exodus is more than just a historical account of how the Jews became a nation. It is an historical account of that. It is a true story. And by the way, the monuments of Egypt and the inscriptions that are found there, all of them confirm, wherever there are points of contact with the story, they are all confirming points of contact rather than contrasting between the secular Egyptian history recorded on their monuments and that of the book of Exodus. In fact, there's every reason to believe that the book of Exodus is at least as historical and as reliable a historical document as any other of Egyptian history of the period that exists. And, of course, no one is quite sure exactly which pharaohs are the pharaohs involved here, and it's interesting that they aren't named for us. And perhaps it's interesting that the midwives who spared the Jewish children, they are named, and yet the pharaoh and his daughter are not named, which shows God's respective evaluation of different people. The world would esteem Pharaoh much more highly than these Jewish midwives who were no doubt slaves, and yet God remembers them by name and built them houses, but he destroyed the house of Pharaoh and doesn't even mention his name. So we can see that God does not evaluate people as man does. Well, getting to the book of Exodus itself, it divides into two parts very nicely, and those are two basically equal parts. The first 19 chapters refer to the Jews being delivered from Egypt and taken to Mount Sinai. Now, the first 15 chapters actually take place leading up to the Exodus, and including the Exodus. Up through chapter 12 or so, we have the Jews still in Egypt. In chapters 13 and 14 and 15, we learn of the actual arrangements and the execution of the Exodus. After chapter 15, they're wandering. Not aimlessly, they're being directed by a pillar of cloud that was the presence of God. And he led them several months, I believe it was 3 months, journey to Mount Sinai, down in the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula. And there they got put some good distance between them and Egypt, which made it unlikely that Egypt would ever seek to come after them again. And so there, at Mount Sinai, they remained 11 months. And these 11 months are recorded in the last half of the book, from chapter 20 to chapter 40. And that's the remainder of the book. So the first 19 chapters cover their history from Egypt to Sinai, where they received the law. Then the last chapters, 20 through 40, record their 11 months at Mount Sinai, where they received the law. And by the way, when we get into Leviticus, that also refers to laws that were given to them during those 11 months. So we have quite a lot of written record of what happened during those months at Sinai. The first thing, of course, we read of in chapter 20 is they received the Ten Commandments. And immediately after that, several other ordinances, and we have many interesting things. We also have, and this is extremely significant, the instructions for and the building of the tabernacle, which has tremendous symbolic value and became the first and most significant building the Jews ever had as part of a worshiping structure, place to worship. Well, we don't need to get into that now. We'll get there when we get to the latter half of the book. What we need to understand when we come right into the book of Exodus is that the Jews had been in Egypt for about 300 years now after the death of Joseph. We're looking at a period considerably later than that of Genesis. The book of Genesis closes simply by telling us how the Jews got into Egypt. That was the concern of the book of Genesis, to lead us from the beginning of time, from the creation of the world, through the call of Abraham and the establishing of his family, to the point where they migrate into Egypt. Now that sets the stage for Moses' own lifetime, because Moses was born about 300 years after Joseph's time and was raised up to be the deliverer out of Egypt. Now the Jews, apparently for the majority of their time in Egypt, were not necessarily under hard labor. It does seem that shortly after Moses, or after Joseph died, that the Jews' conditions did diminish They didn't actually get to be as privileged as they had been during the lifetime of Joseph. But they didn't seem to be pressed into hard bondage until near the end of this period of time. The total period of time they spent in Egypt, according to the records of the Scripture, is 430 years. It's not certain where that 430 begins. It might begin with Jacob and his family going into Egypt. That's what most scholars seem to believe. Some believe it starts at some other point. But apparently in Genesis 46, where Jacob and his sons went into Egypt, that begins to tick off the 430 years that were spent until the Exodus. All right, let's begin reading here in the first chapter. It says, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel, which came out of Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob." And it gives the names again of the 12 sons of Egypt, of Israel, excuse me, in Egypt. "And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them." Notice how many expressions, about six expressions, are used in this one verse to explain their population growth. In fact, it was tremendous population growth, though not miraculous. At the end of this, when they came out into the wilderness and the numbering was taken in the book of Numbers, when they first came out of Egypt, there were numbered something like 600,000 men over 20 years old. Now, there were about 70 men over 20 years old when they went into Egypt. But when they came out, there were about 600,000 men over 20 years old, besides women and children. So if we assume there were a similar number of women, that puts the amount well over a million people. And then, of course, if you add children under 20 years old to the list, you might have easily 2 million to 3 million people, depending on how many children of those age groups there were. So it would seem very possible that there were 2 to 3 million people here. Now, some have felt, many scholars who are skeptical of the accuracy of the records, now these are liberal scholars who usually are trying to find fault with the Bible in any way they can, they usually suggest that this is much too large a number. Moses couldn't have led that many people around and fed them and so forth in the wilderness. Of course, they don't take into account the fact that God was the one that fed them, was manna. It was not Moses that did so. And they often think that it's impossible that the numbers could have grown so much while they were in Egypt. Usually the reason they say that is because they reckon the 430 years from the entrance of Abraham into Egypt. Because Abraham, a couple hundred years before Jacob, went into Egypt, you know, to sojourn for a while and went out. And they say, well, the 430 years actually began with Abraham. And therefore, when Joseph went in and his family, it was only 100 years or so after that the Exodus took place, and the Jews couldn't have increased so much. But of course, that's a very unnatural understanding of the 430 years, to suggest that the 430 years of bondage began with Abraham in Egypt. And I believe that it's safer to say that the 430 years began with Jacob going in, and in that period of time, the 70 men and their families could easily have multiplied to 600,000 men and their families in that period of time, simply by doubling their size. The population would have to double its size every 25 years. That means only that by the time the average man was 25 years old, he would have to have had four children or less. And he could have, actually two children would double it. And of course, any more than that would increase it more. And so the likelihood is great that the population could have easily doubled every 25 years. Excuse me. And that would be all that's necessary to increase to the large number that the Bible attributes to the populations here. So we needn't question it. It seems like they were quite large in number, and we will, just for our purposes, suggest there may have been about 3 million people. There certainly must have been at least 2 million, and probably closer to 3 million. All right? Now, it says, no wonder it says they were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed great and mighty, and the land was filled with them. The land of Goshen, that is. "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." Now, it's not likely that this king was totally ignorant of who Joseph was. Someone as notable as Joseph in Egyptian history would not have failed to be recorded in the records. But, in fact, there are even records found in the monuments today of a foreign nomad that came in and became a counselor to the Pharaoh and a mighty man in Egypt, and it may be even a record of Joseph. this new king, probably was not one who had never heard of Joseph, only one who didn't respect Joseph, didn't honor Joseph, didn't know him in the sense of giving him any kind of recognition as having any rights in the land. And this is probably because that most of the Jews' years in Exodus was taken up in the period of the Hyksos pharaohs, as we mentioned before. It is known that for several hundred years, the Egyptians were reigned over not by native pharaohs, but by invaders, aliens, who had come in from Phoenicia, who were shepherd kings, as Josephus calls them. And the shepherd kings, the Hyksos, ruled Egypt against the culture and against the religion of Egypt for some hundreds of years. And that's probably the general period of time during which the Jews were in Egypt, and that might be why they were treated so nicely during that time. But then we know from history that the 18th dynasty of pharaohs came in, and they overthrew the Hyksos and drove them out, and then restored all the Egyptian ways and the Egyptian religion. And that would possibly be why this king came up. He might have been the one. This would be Ames, I think, although there's much debate among scholars as to which pharaoh this would be, largely because the Egyptologists themselves are not even sure of the right chronology of the pharaohs. The only real good chronology of the pharaohs that was ever made up by Manetho about 250 years before Christ, and that man's writings are totally gone. They've been preserved only in the writings of Eusebius, and it comprised of a list of 30 dynasties of pharaohs, and it's not even sure if any of them were contemporaneous or if they followed one after another. So it's almost impossible, really, for an accurate chronology of early Egyptian history to be decided upon. And that's why there's much confusion as to which of the pharaohs were involved here. But if we suggest that this pharaoh who knew not Joseph was the pharaoh who drove out the Hyksos pharaohs, then that would explain why he didn't honor Joseph. In fact, he'd want to get the Jews under his control more, because they were of the type as the Hyksos. In fact, we read that every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Well, the Hyksos pharaohs were shepherd kings. They were shepherds who came in from Phoenicia and overran the country and took it over. And that might be why the Egyptians hated shepherds. And since the Jews had originally been shepherds, of course, the pharaoh who overthrew the Hyksos would probably have a vested interest in hating them, because they too were Semitic shepherds, as their conquerors, their former oppressors, had been. Anyway, whoever this pharaoh was, it's clear he didn't feel like he owed Joseph or his kin anything. And so things turned around for the Jews here. They were not yet called Jews. They were the sons of Israel in those days, the children of Israel. And he said to his people in verse 9, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we." Now, this could be an exaggeration. It may be that they were sufficiently near in size and population that he was threatened. But it's also possible that the Israelites were more in number than the Egyptians at this point. It's not known with any clearness or accuracy what the population of Egypt was in those days. But it is known that during the census taken during Roman times, hundreds of years later, thousands of years later, in Roman times, the population of Egypt was only 7 million. And so in the days of Moses, the population of Egypt could have been considerably less. And if the Israelites numbered 3 million, it's possible that their numbers might have been at least equal to or greater than that of the Egyptians themselves. So he might have been exaggerating when he said these sons of Israel are more and mightier than we, or he might have been stating a very accurate truth. "Come on, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they also join with our enemies and fight against us, and so get them out of the land." So he was concerned that they might escape from the land by joining with some invading army and overthrowing the Egyptians. Now, the reference to them escaping from the land suggests that already there was some sense in which they were held there, that they would want to escape from there. We don't know to what degree, but they might have already been made servants of the Egyptians, though we don't have any record of them being mistreated in that capacity until later. But they might have already been serving the Egyptians at this point. But here he wants to deal wisely with them, which he tried. What he wanted to do, really, is diminish their population, and that's what's seen clearly throughout this chapter. He has three different attempts to diminish the population of the Jews. The first attempt, of course, was to subject them to hard labor, and perhaps hoping that many of them would die under that kind of treatment, or that they would feel less like reproducing or something. And for some reason, he thought that would diminish their populations, but it didn't work, as we find. And then his next ploy was to kill them at birth by the midwives, and then his third ploy was to throw the male babies into the river. Anyway, it says, therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh the treasure cities of Pithom and Raamses. Now, this Raamses is just an ancient name for the city of Egypt that's now called Tanis. And Pithom is one of the cities that has been excavated and has yielded some interesting confirmations of the book of Exodus, which we'll make reference to when we get to chapter 5. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Actually, grieved is not a good translation. What is literally meant here is that they were in awe. They were astounded at the children of Israel, because they, even though they afflicted them and put taskmasters over them and so forth, yet the children of Israel increased. They didn't diminish, but increased in population, and it caused the Egyptians to be in awe. And it says, and the Egyptians made their children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them to serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of the one was Shiphrah, and the name of the other Puah. Now these two women were probably not the only midwives serving 600,000 families. We could probably keep two midwives busy full-time just in this small community. But they were probably the heads of the midwife guilds. There were probably a large number of midwives, who, and these women were heads over the guilds, and therefore were supposed to communicate with the other midwives this order from Pharaoh. It says, and by the way, before we read any further, these names have been found in secular writings, not necessarily of these same two women, but the fact that these names were in common use in those days is evident from two different sources. The name Shiphrah has been located in Egyptian slave lists from the 1900s BC. Shiphrah in the Egyptian slave list from the 20th century BC has been found. And Puah is also found in the Rosh Shamra texts. These secular sources also have the names of these women, though again, they may not be the same women, but the fact that the same names are there shows that this story is at least accurate in that it uses names of, that were in common use at the time. Now the Pharaoh called these two women, the midwives, and said, when you do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then you shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then you shall let him live. Now apparently, though it's not stated clearly, they were supposed to very subtly kill the child and give the impression that it was still born. The reason for this is that the ploy that they used, well, the answer they gave later wouldn't make any sense unless this was the plan. If they were supposed to kill the child knowingly, with the parents knowing that the child was being killed by the midwives, then the explanation these midwives later gave to Pharaoh wouldn't make any sense and wouldn't hold any water. But apparently what he wanted them to do was to, when they noticed that the child was a boy, maybe strangle the child very subtly and give the impression it was stillborn so that the male children would not increase. They didn't mind the females increasing because, of course, they very few rebellions are staged by females. Only in our generation has that happened. And also because, of course, they could use the women for their harems and things like that. But the men were the problem, and so they wanted to wipe out the baby boys. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have ye done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and they are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass that the midwives, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses, or that he built families of them. They became notable families, their families did. Now, what they suggested is that they couldn't get there soon enough to deliver the baby. Now, if they were supposed to kill the baby anyway, even after it was already born and, you know, openly to do so, it wouldn't make any sense to make this complaint. But if they were supposed to be there when the baby was delivered and then subtly kill it, then it would make sense that, well, we couldn't do it because the baby was born before we got there. The women were delivering their own babies. Suggesting that because the Hebrew women were more rigorous and worked harder and so forth, that they delivered their babies faster, which, of course, is probably a valid thing. Now, there's no reason to believe these women were lying, although they certainly weren't telling the whole truth. They certainly didn't disclose their motives, that they feared God and they would refuse to do what the king said. They might have been telling a half-truth. It might have even been fully a truth, that because the Israelite women were not pampered and living on, you know, lives of ease like the Egyptian women were, that they did have their babies faster, and maybe in some cases the midwives deliberately stalled and let the babies be born before they came in. It's possible these women weren't lying, but even if they were, that doesn't establish a principle endorsing lying. Many people in the Bible lied, and even in some cases good results came of it, but that doesn't mean, and the Bible nowhere says that lying was all right. Rahab the harlot, for instance, lied, and she's commended not for her lying, but for her faith in championing the cause of God's people rather than her own people. But the fact that she lied is not necessarily ever spoken in favor of her. The deception that Rebekah and Jacob foisted on Isaac to get the blessing on Jacob accomplished God's ends, but the Bible does not indicate in any sense that they were right to do it that way. God could have accomplished his ends some other way. But it's just history. It's just telling true history that these people said these things. Now, God blessed these women, but not for their lying, but because they feared God. And very often God will wink at evil or will forgive evil because a person's heart is right and because they're doing something that is technically not exactly right, but their heart is right toward God. And, of course, these people lived prior to any divine revelation from God, so they didn't... I mean, God cut them a little slack there. And he blessed them and built them up because they feared him. And so, of course, the children of Israel continued to multiply. And it says in verse 21, "And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, Every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive." So it didn't work putting them under hard bondage. They just kept growing in number. And it didn't work giving the midwives a charge to kill the male children, because they didn't carry it out. So he finally said, "Forget the midwives. I'll just tell all my people, any of you who sees a Hebrew baby boy, throw it in the river." Now, it was during that time that Moses was born to a Levite family. Of course, in those days, the Levites were not a special group. It was later that they became a special tribe and the priestly tribe. In these days, it was just one of the other families of the Jews. But it happens that Moses' parents were both of the tribe of Levi. We don't have their names given in chapter 2, but their names are given in chapter 6, verse 20. His father's name was Amram, and his mother's name was Jochebed. And those names are given to us in Exodus 6 and verse 20, though their names are not here in this chapter. Chapter 2, "And there went a man of the house of Levi," which was Amram, "and took to wife a daughter of Levi," which was, of course, Jochebed. "And the woman conceived and bare a son." Well, this wasn't her first. She had a 3-year-old son already before Moses was born, and that was Aaron, who was 3 years older. And she also had a fairly mature daughter. We don't know how old, but it seems at least 10 or 12 or maybe even older. And that was Miriam. Yes?
So Aaron was spared because he was over 2 years old?
Yeah, Aaron was old, and he was 3 years older than Moses, and apparently was born before the decree was made. And so it was a decree that was supposed to affect only little infants. And so he was a toddler and probably talking and so forth. And he edge there. Now, it's well known now that the Egyptian capital in those days was on a branch of the river where there were not many crocodiles. Mostly the River Nile is crocodile infested. But the part of the river where the capital of Egypt was placed was apparently chosen partly because there were few or no crocodiles in that area. And that's why the daughter of the king of Egypt would feel free to go and bathe there in the river. No one today would would bathe in crocodile infested waters. They are man eaters, and over 1,000 Africans are eaten by crocodiles every year as they bathe or as they go draw water from lakes and so forth. And crocodiles are very dangerous animals. But this baby was probably not in danger of being eaten by crocodiles because of the particular location. Now, whether it was purposeful that Jacob had placed the baby right at the spot where the Pharaoh's daughter bathed, as probably the Pharaoh's daughter bathed in the same spot or roughly the same spot all the time, and Jacob might have known of this, or whether it was just the providence of God, we don't know. But we know it must have been awfully difficult to leave a 3-month-old baby unattended. And knowing, of course, that he could no longer be hid. A 3-month-old baby cries a great deal, needs to be fed frequently, needs to be changed from time to time. And she must have known that she couldn't just leave him there long term. She must have felt, she probably timed it so that he only had to be there a very short time, knowing that the Pharaoh's daughter came down at regular intervals, daily or whatever, to come and wash herself. I think probably this was designed by the mother to be in the right place at the right time, though certainly God had his hand in it too, and he gave success to the plot. She put the ark in the river's brink, or at the edge of the river, and his sister, which is Miriam, stood afar off to wit or to know what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. And she had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Now, of course, she knew the law. She was Pharaoh's daughter. She should have taken the baby and thrown him in the river. But being a compassionate woman, who could do that, picking up a weeping 3-month-old baby and just toss him in the river? In fact, it's interesting, from the Egyptian Book of the Dead, one of the rites, or one of the things that the Egyptians had to be prepared to say before the God of Judgment, after they died, they would have to be able to say with a clean conscience that they had never denied food to a nursing baby. And so that Egyptian Book of the Dead might have been embodied traditions that were held by the Egyptians in those days, so that she couldn't just, here's this baby that needs nursing and needs food and is crying, she couldn't just deny food to it and hope to stand before the gods blameless later. And so she had compassion on the baby. She knew what was going on. She said, "Oh, this is one of the Hebrews' babies. It's doomed to die." Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call thee a nurse of the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for thee?" So Miriam pops up, just happened to be passing by, she acts like, and says, "Oh, I see you have a baby. Maybe you'd need a nurse to nurse it for you. You obviously don't want to bother to nurse it yourself." And so the Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. Now, this is an amazing thing, and this is another case where God just directs history and causes the Pharaoh's daughter to hire the mother to nurse it. Here, the mother who couldn't keep it for free before and was really obligated by law to kill it, now she gets to nurse it and be paid for it, and it, with government protection. If anyone would come after the baby now and say, "Well, this baby must be thrown in the river," Jochebed could say, "No, this is the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. This is of the royal family, and no one would dare touch him then." So Jochebed got probably 3 years with the baby. It was customary in ancient times for women to nurse the babies for about 3 years before weaning. And so, of course, in 3 years' time, anything after about 2 years old, a baby can be instructed in a lot of things. And I believe that Moses received his early training and his awareness of being a Hebrew and of the promises made to the Hebrews and of the true God and so forth. I believe he received that during the first 3 years of his life, especially probably that between his second and third birthday. And he would therefore be ingrained with the idea that he was of this Hebrew race, not an Egyptian, and that God had made promises to draw the Hebrews out of Egypt. Now, as Moses would grow up with that awareness, he would see, of course, that the only way that God could ever bring them out of Egypt would be either to overthrow the Egyptian government and bring in a new government that treated the Jews nicely and let them go home, or else by them just escaping somehow through some rebellion or deliverance. And so he had this in his mind, we find, when he grew up. It says in verse 10, "And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses," which is an Egyptian name, similar to several other Egyptian names. Actually, the name Moses is fairly common. It means to draw out. And she named him that because she said, "I drew him out of the water." The name became appropriate for other reasons, of course, because God used him to draw out the people of Israel out of Egypt, too. But there are many Egyptian names that have the name Moses as part of it. Ramosi and Thutmose and many other Egyptian names have variations of the name Moses in them. "And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown." Now it skips over 40 years here of his life without giving any details. Acts 7:23 tells us he was at this point 40 years old. And maybe I should, before we read on in this verse, tell you what else Acts chapter 7 tells us about Moses' life, since Exodus doesn't mention it. But Stephen does in his inspired speech before the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 7. We get a little more detail about Moses' life under 40 years old. It says in Acts 7, 21 through 23, "And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and deeds. And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren of the children of Israel." And then we have the story that we're coming to now in Exodus. So of his first 40 years, we have only this information. He was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, of all cultures of the time. No nation placed a higher premium on education than the Egyptians. And the average Egyptian education included education in the sciences, but of course, Moses, being of the royal family, would also have education in law and theology and philosophy and a lot of other things too. Now, to what degree any of those things stuck with him or were, you know, became part of anything he taught later, we don't know. It seems certain that the things he wrote in the Pentateuch were not carried over from Egypt. They were things that he received by divine revelation from God. But he had a great education, and it says he was mighty in words and in deeds. Now, that's no doubt why he felt like he had the confidence and what it takes to deliver the people. When a person feels like he's able to do what God's calling him to do, he's not ready to do it. If a person feels like he's got what it takes to accomplish the goals that God has shown him that he has for his life, that person needs to be reconditioned. And it was God's purpose to reduce Moses to the place where he had no self-confidence at all. And we find that though he was mighty in words and in deeds at 40 years old, yet at 80 years old, 40 years later, when God met him at the burning bush, Moses said, "I'm a man of slow speech. Who am I to stand before Pharaoh?" You see, here he was a man of tremendous qualification before he left Egypt. But after spending 40 years wandering in the wilderness, tending sheep, which was an abomination for his Egyptian training and conditioning, he was humbled. And when God called him to go back to Egypt and do the very thing that he wanted to do earlier, he said, "Who, me? No way, I'm not the man." And God had really made him to the point where he was actually qualified to do it because he was humbled and was able to trust in God. Well, going back to Exodus then, it says, I might add to this, too, about what his mighty words and deeds are. The historian, the Jewish historian, Josephus, indicated that Moses led the southern army of Egypt, that he was the commander of the southern army. But that is not to be taken as necessarily fully accurate, because Josephus didn't have any more information than we have, except he had the traditions of the rabbis, and those may or may not have any validity to them. He had the same scriptures we have, and they don't mention anything about that. So It may or may not be true that Moses was a military commander in the southern army, but that's what Josephus, the historian, said. Anyway, in the day, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said unto him that did the wrong, Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, Who madest thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedst the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, Surely the thing is known. Now, Moses, when he killed the Egyptian, what was he thinking? Of course, he was reacting out of just compassion to his countrymen. He saw his countrymen being abused by an Egyptian. And yet, technically, Moses was an official of the Egyptian court. The man who was smiting the Hebrew was an Egyptian officer carrying out his duty. And Moses immediately sided with his people against the people that had raised him and trained him. And this was a decisive act on his part because he was making a choice. Am I going to side with the Egyptian, an officer, even as I am an officer among the Egyptians, and this man's carrying out his duty as an officer? Or am I going to side with my people, the oppressed? And this decision he made, according to Hebrews chapter 11, that he would refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and he would side with the afflicted people of God, refusing to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, and esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than all the treasures of Egypt. That's how Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 23 talks about this situation. Now, how does Acts chapter 7 talk about it, the passage we were looking at before? Here's how Stephen tells the story. It says in verse 23 of Acts 7, And when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, and he smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. So you see, he thought they'd understand. Don't you see? Isn't it obvious? Here I am, your Hebrew brother, and God's placed me in a high position in the office. It's evident that God has raised me up to deliver you. Now, God had not yet called Moses to deliver him, but Moses already had that vision. Moses already put two and two together. He'd been told by his mother that the Jews would someday be led free from the Egyptians. For 40 years, he'd seen that he'd received privileges and high office in Egypt. He, if anyone, was in the position and had the motive to release the Jews. And so it was just understood in his mind, I'm the one who's called by God to let our people go. But he expected his countrymen to know that too. But they apparently just resented him. The fact that he was their countryman made it all the worse, because here they were slaving and he was living in a bed of roses. And they thought, well, here comes Mr. Pampered, you know, as though he's really betrayed them by being in the Egyptian court. Well, he thought they'd realize that he'd come to deliver them, but they didn't understand that. Now, he made sure to look both ways to see that no one was looking, and the Bible says there was no man. So who told? By the next day, when he saw two Jews fighting with each other, and said to the one who was wronging his neighbor, Why do you do this? The man says, Who made you a judge over us? Will you smite me like you did the Egyptian? In one day, the story had gotten out. Who had told it? The only person who could have told the story was the guy that Moses had defended the other day. The Egyptian was dead. No one else had watched. Only the man that had been defended could have been the one. And so apparently the news got around among the slaves that this had happened. And of course that raised a lot of eyebrows, because here Moses was a high Egyptian official. And he'd come and killed an Egyptian who was doing his duty with a Hebrew slave. And so Moses realized that the thing was out. But the slave didn't seem to be grateful. And they said, Who made you a judge and a ruler over us? It's interesting that later in Stephen's speech, in Acts 7:35, it says this, Moses, whom they refused, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge? The same did God send to be a ruler and a deliverer, by the hand of the angel which appeared to him in the bush. That's Acts 7:35. The Jews said, "Who made you to be a ruler and a judge?" And God, Stephen says, God made him to be a ruler and a deliverer of his people. All right? Maybe we could turn that heater off back there, Minnie. Thank you. All right. Pretty warm. Back in Exodus chapter 2 then, when this man said to Moses, "Are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian yesterday?" Verse 15, immediately Moses thought, surely the thing is known. Then verse 15 says, "Now when the Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." Now the story of his flight from Pharaoh must have been an interesting one, but Moses, who leaves the record for us, doesn't tell us anything about it because he doesn't want to just dazzle us with an exciting story. It must have been rather exciting to flee from the most powerful man in the world when you lived right in his house. And as soon as Pharaoh heard about it, and Moses could never know quite when Pharaoh heard about it, until, of course, the officers came to arrest him. Somehow he escaped out his window or something and fled. Somehow he had to get out of the country. He made it out to the same place that he would later have to lead the Jews out. The fact that he was able to get out, that must not have been that easy. If it was that easy, the Jews themselves could have walked out too. That he must have gone through the border guard and everything to get out, and he ended up in the land of Midian, which was, as he might have thought, going to be a relatively friendly land, since the Midianites were descended from Abraham also. Of course, Moses and the Jews were descended from Abraham through his son Isaac, but the Midianites were descended from Abraham through one of the sons of Keturah. Keturah was a concubine of Abraham's and had given rise to these people. So there were relatives here in Midian, though they had never met, of course. And he went down to Midian and he sat down by a well. This was down in the Sinai Peninsula. And the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled troughs to water their flocks, their father's flocks. And the shepherds came down and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flocks. So apparently the shepherd boys were kind of harassing these girls. There were these 7 girls watering their father's flocks, but the shepherd boys didn't want to share the water with them. And Moses happened to be there resting and saw this happening, so he stood up and defended the girls and drove off the shepherds. And so when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you come so soon today?" Apparently it was rather customary that the shepherds would drive them away, and it'd take them a long time to ever get any water for their flocks. Had to wait for the other shepherds to be gone, I guess. He said, how'd you come back so soon today? And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock." And he said unto his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man, and he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter, as a wife. And she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, which means a stranger here. For he said, "I have been a stranger in a strange land," which is where that expression first came from, not from the novel, nor from Leon Russell. And it came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Okay, so 2 things happened here of significance at the end of this time that Moses spent with Jethro, or Reuel, as he is sometimes called. In verse 18, he's called Reuel, the father-in-law of Moses, but he's also called in chapter 3 and verse 1, Jethro. The man had more than one name by which he went. And the one thing of importance is that the king of Egypt died. Now that's important because Moses could never have gone back and stood before Pharaoh with an outstanding charge, a capital charge against him. We find that in the following story, Moses and Aaron went frequently into the Pharaoh's court and stood before him and made demands. But he could never have stood before the very Pharaoh that had sought to slay him without being arrested. So this Pharaoh died and was replaced. It might have even been a new dynasty that came in so that any of the political criminals of the previous dynasty would be totally amnesty would be shown, because they would have no, the new dynasty would have no particular hostility toward them. At any rate, the things didn't get better for the children of Israel in Egypt, and they continued to be under hard bondage, and they cried, and it says God heard them. Now, by this time, when we get to chapter 3, another 40 years have passed. So in chapter 2, we have 80 years of Moses' life recorded. The first 40 are mentioned without much mention of him in Egypt. Then the second 40 are mentioned again without very little detail, with very little detail also. And now he's 80 years old when we get to chapter 3. And this is where he meets God. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. Now that's not Horeb, is also Sinai. This is the mountain of God. Now, it wasn't called the mountain of God in those days, but writing this later, Moses called it the mountain of God. And so this is the very mountain where God later gave the Ten Commandments. But on this occasion, he doesn't give the Ten Commandments. He just introduces himself to Moses and gives Moses a command to go and set the people free. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. Now, when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, and he was afraid to look upon God. Now, this sign of the burning bush, it's not certain exactly what the meaning of it was. Why that sign instead of some other one, a bush that was burning but not consumed. Of course, we remember that the Bible says that our God is a consuming fire. It says that in Hebrews, but that doesn't necessarily give us a clue as to why this bush was burning and not being consumed. It seems likely that the bush represented Israel, the nation, the people. And the fire burning it seemed to be the persecution that they were undergoing at the hands of the Egyptians. Later on, Moses in Deuteronomy and Jeremiah in the book of Jeremiah spoke of the Egyptian captivity as a burning furnace, or as an iron furnace. That is to say, they were under heat, they were under pressure, and they were burning, but they weren't burning up. That is, God was preserving them, just as God was in the fire, preserving the bush from being burned, even though the fire was there. So the Jews were enduring the fires of persecution, but they were not being consumed either. The nation was still being preserved, miraculously, through it all, by God, because he was present in their circumstances also. Well, Moses just thought it was an amazing thing. He saw a burning bush. Probably bushes that were burning was fairly unusual anyway. It'd have to be lightning that would have struck it or something that would cause it to happen. But then when he observed it for a while, he saw that it never got any more burnt. It just had fire, but it wasn't being consumed. And so he said, I'm going to turn aside and see this great sight. And that's when God spoke to him and introduced himself as the God of your father, Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. In other words, not any of the gods that Moses had learned about in Egypt, but the God that his mother had told him about, the God of his ancestors. And Moses was afraid to look on God. And it says, And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land into a good place, into a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, and a place of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send thee unto Pharaoh, that thou mayest bring forth my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. So here's his call. He says, I'm sending you to go to Pharaoh to call the children of Israel out of Egypt. Now, 40 years earlier, Moses would have said, well, it's about time. Let's go for it. I'm ready.
You know, now I've got God on my side, I'm especially equipped, you know. And so he would have been really confident. He was confident enough even not knowing God before. But now he is totally a changed man. Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And he said, "Certainly I will be with thee. And this shall be the token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain." And that's why when Moses brought them out of Egypt through the Red Sea, he brought them back down to that mountain, and that's where they received the Ten Commandments. God said, this will be a token that it's really me that did it. That someday you'll be able to look back and you'll be standing at this mountain again, but you'll be standing with 3 million people around you, and you'll know that I sent you. Now, you see, Moses is a little reticent here to accept the call. He's been greatly humbled by his failure, first of all. He totally is a failure in his attempt to deliver the people previously. He has spent the 40 years in exile from his own people and also from the people that had adopted him, the Egyptians. He's just a total stranger. That's why he named his son Gershom, a stranger here. He's a stranger in a strange land. And, of course, he's not only done that, but he spent the whole time as a shepherd, which, according to all the conditioning he would have received as an Egyptian, that was an abominable trade. And so he stepped down from one of the highest positions in Egypt to that which would be considered abominable and lowly in the eyes of Egyptians. And so he was humbled by this. By the way, he spent the same period of time doing that as he'd spent the other way. Some have pointed out that Moses' life equally divides into three periods of 40 years each. And the first period, of course, he spent learning how great he was. The second period, he spent learning how little he was. And the fourth, third period, then, he spent leading the people, actually coming into his ministry. Though he lived 120 years, God didn't release him into the ministry until he was 80 years old, because it took that much conditioning. And it's amazing how many times Christians sometimes feel like they're ready to jump right into the ministry as soon as they get a little bit of Bible knowledge under their belt, you know, or even if they don't have Bible knowledge under their belt. I've known people to feel like just because they're zealous, they're prepared. But God takes a man through a long process of humbling before he really releases him. I've seen people released without that process of humbling. I've seen people go into ministry without being broken. And it's disastrous. Sometimes they even have big ministries, which is even the more disastrous. The more people they affect, the worse it is. But when a person's gone through that period of breaking and humbling and so forth, then, of course, that's when God's ready to call him. And in every case, when God calls a man who's been properly prepared, he says, "Who, me? No way." That's what Isaiah said. When God called Isaiah, Isaiah says, "Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips." I'm certainly not God's man of the hour, but he was. When God called Jeremiah, Jeremiah said, "Oh, but I'm only a child. I'm only young." God said, "Don't say you're a child. I'm going to be with you." See? He felt he was unqualified. When he was calling Peter to follow him, Peter said, "Oh, depart from me, Lord. I'm a man of a sinner, a sinful man." And so we don't find that the men that God really called for great purposes were men who were of great self-confidence. Now, Paul, of course, when God first converted Paul, he was a man of great abilities. And he started preaching right off. When he got to Damascus, he started preaching. But apparently, not very effectively. We don't read of any converts, and he got driven out of town in the night, being lowered from a window in the wall in a basket, and it seems to have been a humiliating experience for him, because he later spoke of it as part of his humiliation when he spoke of all the things that had happened to him in 2 Corinthians. It wasn't until some period later, almost 14 or 17 years later, it's not sure when, but considerably later, that he was actually released to be an apostle by the Church of Antioch. And when he was an apostle, he had a very different opinion of his own abilities. He wrote about it in Philippians chapter 3. He said, "The things that were gained to me, I count them loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ." He says, "I was a Jew of the first rank, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, of the tribe of Benjamin, circumcised the eighth day, according to the righteousness that is of the law, blameless. Concerning zeal, I persecuted the church." He said, those things were all considered good. When God called him, he thought he was just the man God needed for this job, because he had all the qualifications. When he first came to Jerusalem, just must have been about, I'm trying to think of which occasion it was. Seems like it was 3 years after his conversion. He came to Jerusalem, and God said, "Get out of this town. They won't receive your testimony here." And he says, "Oh God, but I've got the perfect testimony for these people. These people in Jerusalem, they know me. They know my background. I've got a powerful testimony." And God says, "No, get out. I'm sending you to the Gentiles." But Paul thought he was the right guy for that ministry. He still had too much self-confidence. And it wasn't until he came to see himself as nothing and to count all the things that were profitable and beneficial to him formerly as only hindrances that he really was made and released to be the great apostle that he became. So here also, Moses learned how great he was for the first 40 years of his life, then spent another 40 years learning how small he really was. And now that God sends him, he's more than reticent. He's really reluctant. He will not accept without objections. He actually, in the course of his discussion with God here in the next couple chapters, he raised no less than 5 objections. He said, "I can't do it." But God always gave an answer to him. As we'll see, I'll summarize them when we've covered them all, instead of giving them all to you now. But he says, "Who am I that I should speak unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And God said, "Certainly I will be with thee." And they told him he'd bring him back to that mountain with the children of Israel. Verse 13, "And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they say unto me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them?" All the Egyptian gods, and there were many of them, they all had names. But what name shall I give them for you? And they say, "Well, which God? What's his name?" God said unto Moses, "I am that I am." And he said, "Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you." Now this "I am that I am," God gives as his name. Actually, his name is I am. Apparently, he said, "You tell the children of Israel, I am hath sent you." I am is the name that he adopts for himself. When he says, "I am that I am," what he's simply saying is, "You want to know who I am? I am that I am." I am is the name. The second I am is, it's like he says, "I am that Jehovah," is really what he's saying. "I'm Jehovah." Because the name Jehovah comes from the words "I am." In fact, the Hebrew here is Iyeh, Asher Iyeh. I don't know if I pronounce Hebrew correctly, but that's "I am that I am." And in the first person, it says, "I am who I am." But in the third person, it becomes, "He is." And that is the name Yahweh. The name Yahweh or Jehovah means "He is." Uh-huh. Or it's just basically a form of the Hebrew word to be. And YHWH or JH. VH, depending on how the consonants are rendered into English, makes what is called the tetragrammaton or the tetragram, 4 letters, 4 consonants that came to be used for the name of God by the Hebrews. It was considered to be the unpronounceable name of God. When vowels are added to it, which the Old Testament does not do, but which some scholars have done, you can expand those 4 letters to make it say Yahweh or Jehovah. And, of course, we've mentioned before, anytime you find the word "Lord" in all capital letters, it is that tetragrammaton. It's those 4 letters that are expanded to be Jehovah or Yahweh if we want to try to pronounce it. But why did he call himself that? Why is his name "I am that I am"? There may be a number of reasons that would be valid, and maybe all of them are valid, or maybe one of them is. We can't be too certain. He doesn't say why that's his name, but there are at least 3 things I'd like to suggest. One is that in saying "I am," he was contrasting himself to all the other gods who are not. Because the other gods really don't exist. The other gods are only figments of their worshippers' imagination. Whereas he really does exist. Say, "I'm the one who really is, I am," as opposed to all the other gods who really are not. And so that could be one of the meanings of "I am," simply to say, I am the existing God. I am the one who is self-existent, and all other gods, of course, don't exist at all. Another thing that could be implied in it is that it seems like an uncompleted sentence. I am what, you know? And he doesn't give any what. He doesn't tell us what he is. He just says, I am, perhaps suggesting that there's no way that sentence could be completed to adequately explain who he is. He encompasses so much. He is so great that no words could express what he is. He is simply what he is. You can't finish the sentence. I am what? I could say, I am Steve Gregg, or I am a man, or I am an American, or I am a Bible teacher, or I am warm in this room, or I have, you know, I'm well, or I'm sick. I can finish that sentence many ways, and it, you know, in a sense, they carry enough information, but no word that you could complete that sentence with, I am blank, fill in the blank, nothing you could fill in the blank with quite adequately describes who God is, because he's more than can be described. So he simply says, I am what I am. There's nothing, it really can't explain it any more specifically than that. All the above, yeah. Right. And there is one other thing, too. He had already identified himself in verse 6 as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And, of course, that would mean he was the God of the Jews' history. He was God of Moses' ancestors. He's the God of their past. But here he's stressing he's not only the God of their past, he's also still with them. He's still the God of the present. I am. I'm not just I was. I was with Abraham. I was with Jacob. But I am now still. I haven't died. I still exist. And maybe it's that point that he's stressing also, because he has identified himself with the Jews' past in verse 6. But now he's stressing that I am still here. I am in the present. Some have suggested that I am suggests the eternal present. Now, I don't go too far with this, though it could be true. I don't know if it is or not. But some have expanded on this to suggest that God is always in the present, and that nothing else is always in the present. That as soon as I say I am, I've already changed. My blood has flowed a little bit through my veins. I'm in a different state than I was. I've had some cells have died. Some cells have been generated. I'm not completely what I was a moment ago. I'm always in the process of change. Therefore, if I say I am, well, already I'm not that anymore. I'm something else. I have to say I was. But God doesn't change. Therefore, he's always the same, and he can always say I am, and whatever he says at any moment, any moment that he says that, it's the same thing as what he would have meant if he said it before. He doesn't change. And some have gone on to stress that God does not live inside of time, but lives, or does not experience time as we do, but is an unchanging reality living in the eternal now. Now, I don't, again, this is not something the Bible specifically says. Many Christians hold it as though it was taught clearly in the Bible, though it isn't. But some have made this doctrine out of the I am name for God, that he's always in the present. Now, Jesus used this name also for himself, and that's one of the reasons why we know that he's not a lesser God or a lesser deity. He is actually Jehovah God. And, you know, most cults make Jesus out to be a man who realized Christ consciousness, or realized that we all are God, or something like that. Or else they make him out to be a special man, but a lesser God, not like Jehovah God. But the Bible clearly teaches, Jesus taught, that he is Jehovah God. And he even said that if we did not believe that he is, or that he is the I am, that we would die in our sin. But, for instance, in the 8th chapter of John, John chapter 8, in verse 24, Jesus, speaking to the Pharisees, said, I said, therefore, unto you, that ye shall die in your sins, for if ye believe not that I am, ye shall die in your sins. The word he is in italics. It's not in the original. He didn't say, if you believe not that I am he. He said, if you do not believe that I am, that is, identifying himself with Jehovah. Now, whether you maybe you think maybe he wasn't identifying himself with Jehovah when he said that, but if you look further, down to verse 58 of the same chapter. John 8:58. Jesus said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. And then verse 59, Then took they up stones to cast at him. But he hid himself and went out of the temple. Why did they pick up stones to cast at him? Because they knew what he was saying. He was saying that he was Jehovah God. That's blasphemy in the mind of a Jew. And the only way it could not be blasphemy is if it was true. And it was true. And it is true. He is the I Am. He is Jehovah God. And he made it very clear by using that name. And so that's the name that God gave Moses. It later was understood as Jehovah, or the Tetragrammaton, the four letters YHWH, Yahweh or Jehovah, become the substitute for the name I Am. Now going on, we need to finish up here. We only have a few minutes to finish this chapter. Verse 15 of Exodus 3. And God said moreover unto Moses, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say unto them, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you, and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt, unto the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, and they shall hearken to thy voice. And thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel, unto the king of Egypt, and ye shall say unto him, The Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Some people think that by asking for 3 days' journey into the wilderness, Moses was suggesting that they'd only be gone for 3 days. In which case, that would be a lie, because they really intended to never come back. But he didn't say, let us be gone for 3 days. He said, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, which means that's basically how long it would take to get totally free from any reach of Egypt. They could get over the border and travel 3 days in the wilderness. In other words, they'd be pretty much beyond the reach of Egypt. It'd be hard to bring them back at that point. He wanted them to allow the Jews freedom to leave. Basically, leave the country. And it says, And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not by a mighty hand. Now God said, The children of Israel, they will hearken to you, but the king of Israel will not let you go. This is only true at a certain particular point. At first, the children of Israel didn't hearken to him, but later they did, when he started giving the plagues. During the period of the plagues, the Pharaoh was not willing to let them go. So he's talking here about the period of the 10 plagues. During which the children of Israel came to believe that Jehovah had sent Moses, but the Pharaoh was still resisting. And so he says, I'm sure he will not let you go. Of course, eventually he did, and God knew that, because God predicted that that would happen. But he means that Pharaoh's not going to go for this quickly. And I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not by a mighty hand, and I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof, and after that he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall come to pass that when ye go, ye shall not go empty, but every woman shall borrow of her neighbor, actually demand of her neighbor, and of her that sojourneth in her house, jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment, and ye shall put them upon your sons and upon your daughters, and ye shall spoil the Egyptians. This would fulfill the prediction that God had made to Abraham about the people leaving with great substance. We'll talk more about that, because this comes up again.